Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Rick Ruffner, registration 9163, appearing here on behalf of the appellants. We are here today on a very limited issue related to the underlying case, and that is whether the trial court abused its discretion in the manner and method by which it disposed of and ruled upon plaintiff's motions for extension of time to designate expert witnesses. The manner and method by which the trial court ruled on those motions for extension ultimately resulted in the dismissal of the case because the expert opinions were not obtained. We have cited in our brief the three main cases which this court needs to consider. All of them are Supreme Court cases. Those three are the Cook case, the Trattler case, and the Todd versus Bear Valley case.
Let me just, and I apologize for interrupting so quickly, but one of the things that you may address, I would appreciate, is why those cases are pertinent at all to the analysis, given that they all involve sanctions, and this case does not appear to involve sanctions.
Your Honor, I've actually gone to the very next part of my argument because I was going to refer to the Cook case. And I think the Cook case would answer that question. Cook is a very similar situation where there was a motion for extension of time to designate experts. The trial court denied that motion for extension of time, and what the Supreme Court said was that the denial of the motion in that case was the functional equivalent of precluding the testimony of Cook's expert witnesses. It then went on to talk about sanctions under Rule 37 as being the guidance for how to consider that issue. But the Cook case was not a sanction issue. It was again the court failing to exercise its discretion, which had the tantamount effect of causing a dismissal of the case. So I'm arguing that not only is the Cook case on point, but also the theory and philosophy of those cases, which result in a party not having his or her day in court, should be also the guidance that this court uses in determining this issue on the court's exercise of its discretion. The court in Cook, as I just mentioned, indicated that the failure to grant the extension in effect prevented the plaintiff in that case from having its expert witnesses, and that essentially was tantamount to the losing of the case. In essence, the expert witnesses were necessary in Cook, and because of that failure to grant the extension, no experts could testify. Plaintiffs could then not prevail. We have the same thing here. The Cook case also talked about Trattler and talked about the importance of affording parties their day in court. And in looking at the result of its actions upon that ability to have the day in court, as contrasted to the relief requested. The Cook case and the Trattler cases talked about in the exercise of discretion or in the implementation of sanctions that the court has to look as to whether there was a substantial justification for the failure to disclose experts in a proper and timely manner, and whether then that failure to disclose was harmless. In our particular case, in order to analyze those two basic elements, we have to look at the motions for extension. The motion for extension of time was filed by the plaintiffs in this case on March 9th, 2012. For whatever reasons, the court did not rule upon that motion for almost 7 weeks.
One of the reasons was because you filed a motion to recuse the judge, though, right?
That could be the basis. He did not comment on that, but we did file that during that period of time.
Well, he couldn't, under the law, he couldn't rule on it during that period of time, correct?
Right, and I'm not faulting the ruling on the 6 weeks. What I am saying was an abuse of discretion is then not to grant the motion when the court did rule for the period of time that had been requested in order to have the experts complete their opinions. By the time the court did rule, for whatever reasons, and I'm not saying it's not a legitimate reason for delaying ruling pending a motion for recusal, But once it does rule, it rules on April 20th, giving until April 30th. As the original motion had indicated, it was necessary for the experts to have substantially more time than that to complete review of the voluminous record in the case in order to come to their expert opinions.
But what prevented you and your client from moving ahead with the experts during that period of time?
Or even before that period, counsel, even before you filed the motion?
Sir, even before the period, the motion was filed, it was because the monies had not been obtained. They had been working to save the money and come up with the money. They didn't have the money until the late February 2012.
So let me just interrupt you right there, and then you could go on and answer the question to both of us asked. Do you know of any case that says the fact that the plaintiff doesn't have sufficient funds amounts to just either justifiable excuse or under the Trattler Cook cases, substantial justification?
Not directly on point, Your Honor, but I think the cases talk about, and the Todd case and the Trattler case both talk about cases hopefully can be resolved inexpensively. Again, the mere fact that it costs so much to go into litigation and a plaintiff is trying as best he or she can to obtain the monies to go into litigation can, I believe, and I argue, is a justifiable reason for then asking for an extension. Certainly, if they can never come up with the money to obtain the expert opinion, then, of course, the plaintiff cannot go forward. There's nothing that says a plaintiff can or should be allowed to go forward. But here we simply ask for an extension of time, given the circumstances and the cost involved, and that we believe that that warranted an extension of time to designate the expert. As to the reason, even after the motion is filed, that the expert did not commence work, again, it's a very pragmatic decision. If the motion for extension is not going to be granted, then the money being spent for the plaintiffs is all for naught. I mean, we're talking a $10,000 to $13,000 expense. That was the estimate stated in the motion. Why would the plaintiff go ahead and spend that money pending resolution of a motion for extension of time? Because if the court is ultimately going to deny it, then that is wasted money. So that's the reason that it was not done during that period of time. On April 20th, when the order was handed down, giving 10 days now to get the expert to do his work, we then had the second situation that happened, which caused the April 29th motion for extension to be filed, and that's the injury that I suffered, the serious accident on April 18th, 2 days before the order came down. As I indicated in the April 29th motion, I did not expect to be back to work until mid-May, based upon the major surgery that happened on April 25th. That was explained to the court. Also, the need for sufficient time for the experts, again, was restated, as we had stated on March 9th.
Couldn't you at least have disclosed the name of your experts? I mean, maybe they didn't have their opinion done, but couldn't you have at least gotten in the game and disclosed who they were? I mean, that was the situation in Cook. The defendants knew who the expert was. Here, as far as I know, up until today, you still haven't told them who you were going to retain.
Well, there's no requirement other than Rule 16 for disclosure of the expert, but if we are not disclosing the opinions, which go along with all the other required information, we're asking for an extension to do all of that. I mean, I could state today who our expert is, but that was never asked of me by the trial court or by the defendant. I simply asked for an extension of time to designate that expert.
Counsel,
which would have been done, and as we said on March 9th, would be done if we were allowed until April 30th to do that.
Counsel, can I interrupt you quickly?
Sure.
As I understand it, the original deadline for our disclosures was February 11th, 2011?
Yes.
But you did not respond at all to that time until 22 days later. Why did that happen?
Explained in the brief, the rule requiring disclosure of experts would have required disclosure March 15th. Quite frankly, that's when it was tickled to be done, the standard rule deadlines. What was not tickled properly, and that's a mistake in my office, is that the case management order that was done early on changed that date. That change was not properly tickled. What was tickled was the standard disclosures.
But it wasn't just a matter of the case management order, the judge writing an order that came out of the blue sky. That was a stipulation that you both asked for.
That's correct. That's correct. It was. It simply was not tickled, never was considered thereafter, other than the standard deadlines. 3 days before that standard deadline, we moved for an extension of time.
Well, if the trial court had denied your motion for extension of time on the basis, if the trial court had just said, look, you missed the deadline, I'm not going to give you any further extensions, we would also be reviewing that decision for an abuse of discretion, correct?
Potentially, yes.
And why would that be manifestly arbitrary or unreasonable or unfair to have disallowed you any extension?
Well, it gets back again to what Cook and Trapper have both said. If that's going to result in a dismissal, which it would, you have to look at whether there's a substantial justification for it, which I urge that there was, both the financial as well as what I just described to Judge Navarro. And you have to then show that it is not harmless to the opposing party. There was never any harm demonstrated by the defendants in this case by any of the requested motions, none whatsoever. And indeed, that's one of the reasons the Cook case remanded, is because the court made no findings of harm to the other side in supporting its order denying the motions.
Isn't the harm that everybody agreed that a continuance would be required? And isn't that one of the things that the Todd case talks about as showing harm? Everybody agreed that if you were going to get what you wanted, there would have to be a continuance in the trial, which would have been harmful to the defendant. More expense, more delay. Why doesn't that satisfy that test?
First of all, I disagree that if the motion for extension had been granted till April 30th, that it would require an extension or a continuance of the trial date. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to do it by April 30th. And no one has ever made that finding. But the court's presupposing that that would be harm when it never even came up in the case to have that established.
But the trial court granted your extension until April 30th, correct?
I'm sorry.
The trial court granted your extension until April 30th. So you got that relief that you requested.
I got the date, but not the amount of time.
Well, did your motion ask for a specific date or an amount of time after the court ruled?
It asked for a specific date with the justification being that was the amount of time needed between the motion and the date. The other reason the April 30th date was set was to prevent any harm or any prejudice to the trial date. That's why we did it. But then when on April 20th, the court granted it, it now only granted the 10 days. That was the catch-22. We hadn't spent the money because if we're not going to have it granted, why spend the money? And so on. Now we have 10 days. But intervening in that was the major injury I suffered during that same period of time, 2 days before the April 20th order.
Here the trial court granted you two extensions, albeit shorter in terms of number of days than you had asked for. In Cook, the trial court didn't give any extensions. Is that a distinction that's important in the analysis?
Didn't grant any extension. I think that's a distinction without a difference.
Why?
Because of the effect of it. I mean, in Cook, the effect was no experts at all. In our case, the effect of the extensions was no time at all to designate, and therefore not being able to designate. So in a sense, it's the same effect. And you have to look at the effect that Cook was talking about, and I believe that that's what we have to do in this case as well. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Counselor. You have about a minute and 17 seconds left.
May it please the court, my name is Jared Ellis, registration number 36834, and I appear today on behalf of the defendant, appellee, Douglas Romero. I agree with plaintiff's counsel in one respect, and that is that the issue before the court is relatively narrow. It's whether the trial court abused its discretion when it granted our summary judgment motion without affording plaintiffs a third enlargement of time in an effort to disclose expert witnesses. I'd first like to address why the trial court's ruling was not an abuse of discretion. And then if I have time, I'd like to move on to why this court should affirm the trial court's ruling irrespective of the determinations with respect to the motion enlargement of time. I think that the first issue that's important to discuss in this case is the standard. Plaintiff's counsel is arguing that the standard applicable to the trial court's ruling is that that's applied under Rule 37 to sanctions requests under Rule 37. And we disagree. We think that the trial court's ruling is subject to Rule 6B, which essentially allows trial courts to grant enlargements of time based upon good cause shown and subjects those rulings to a very deferential abuse of discretion review. Now, I think there's two reasons that the court should not apply CRCP 37 to the trial court's ruling in this case. The first reason, and the most important reason, is that although plaintiff's counsel is now arguing that Trattler, that the Todd versus Bear Valley Village, and that the Cook case all support their argument and that CRCP 37 applied, plaintiff never made that argument at the trial court level. And as a result, the trial court never had the opportunity to consider whether CRCP 37 applied to its ruling, never had an opportunity to make findings as required by CRCP 37, and in effect, its ruling should not be subject to that standard on appeal. Colorado law is clear that in order to preserve an issue for appeal, a party has to raise that issue in the trial court and at least give the trial court an opportunity to make the necessary findings, and that just wasn't the case here. But the other important reason that CRCP 37 doesn't apply is that in this case, the trial court didn't impose sanctions under Rule 37. And there's a couple of reasons that this is true. The first is that if you look at the Todd versus Bear Valley Village case, what it talks about in terms of sanctions under Rule 37 is exclusion of non-disclosed evidence. And in this case, there was no evidence. Plaintiffs never obtained an expert, they never disclosed expert opinions, and the trial court didn't say your experts won't be allowed to testify at trial. Instead, plaintiffs admitted that they had not obtained an expert witness, sought additional time to get that expert witness, and the trial court denied their request for additional time. The request to extend a procedural deadline to obtain expert witnesses is a request under Rule 6B, not Rule 37. And I think that the reliance on the Cook case really demonstrates the distinction between what the Supreme Court was faced with in Cook and what the trial court was faced with in this case. Because in Cook, as the court pointed out, the plaintiff had witnesses. There were treating physicians, and the defense attorney knew the identities of those witnesses. As a result, when the Supreme Court considered whether the trial court acted appropriately in denying a request for enlargement of time, it looked at the fact that there was potential harmlessness because the identities of the experts were known and there were experts. And that's the reason that the trial court's ruling in the Cook case was more analogous to a sanction under Rule 37 than merely a denial of a request for enlargement of time, because there was evidence that was functionally excluded by the trial court's ruling. That simply wasn't the case here. Now, turning to the standard under Rule 6B, there's really only two requirements that are imposed on the trial court. First of all, the trial court, the plaintiff has to demonstrate good cause, essentially, to obtain an extension of time. And in this case, the real determinative extension of time was the third extension of time that plaintiff requested, which was requested on May 8th, 2012, because the trial court had previously already granted two extensions of time. The other issue is that the trial court's ruling, this court subjects to a deferential standard of review. It doesn't consider whether or not it would have reached the same determination on the same circumstances, but rather whether the trial court's ruling falls within a range of reasonable options. And we believe that the trial court's ruling fell within a range of reasonable options for a number of reasons. First and foremost, plaintiffs were granted almost 3 months of additional time to disclose expert witnesses and merely failed to do so. As the court pointed out, pursuant to the stipulated modification of the case management order, plaintiff's expert disclosures were originally due on February 16, 2012. Plaintiffs didn't request an enlargement of time to file expert disclosures by that date, nor did they file expert disclosures by that date. Rather, they waited until the day after the defendant filed a motion for summary judgment, March 9, 2012, to request an enlargement of time. That enlargement of time they requested through April 30, 2012, and the court granted it. And then after they complained that this first enlargement of time was inadequate and requested a second enlargement of time, the trial court granted them another 10 days through May 10th, 2012. I think the really important question, and what the court was alluding to with some of its questions, is what did plaintiffs do with the time that they were afforded by the trial court? And based upon the motions that were filed, it's very difficult to tell because plaintiffs didn't identify what steps they had taken toward obtaining an expert that was supportive of their claims. They didn't identify what steps remained to be taken so that they could identify and disclose expert witnesses. And quite frankly, they didn't even state whether they consulted any experts. Posed with that record, and on top of that, I think it's also important to note that when they requested their final motion for enlargement of time on May 8th of 2012, they acknowledged that the expert's work has not been commenced. No experts had even started working on the case as of May 8th. Given that they were granted substantial additional time and they failed to use that time, the trial court's ruling was appropriate. But I think it's also important to consider plaintiff's position and their main argument, their central argument as to why they should have been granted additional time, which is that they weren't required to have their experts start working on the case until the trial court granted the enlargements of time and granted them enough time that those experts would have an adequate time to finalize their reports. This argument has no support in Colorado law and is actually contrary to well-established Colorado law. Quite frankly, there's no authority that indicates that filing a motion for enlargement of time allows a party to delay the preparation of their case while that motion is pending. A motion for enlargement of time is not a license to put off preparation of a party's case. And instead, Colorado law is quite explicit that a party has an obligation to diligently prepare their case throughout every phase of pretrial and trial phases. And on top of that, Colorado law is also explicit that there's no requirement that a trial court grant a motion for enlargement of time. So in other words, it's not reasonable for plaintiffs to insist that they were entitled to an enlargement of time when, for example, the Moyer case that we cited states that it's not an abuse of discretion whatsoever for the trial court to not rule on a motion for enlargement of time, and that a party who delays beyond an unextended deadline does so at their own peril. Plaintiff's position is just not reasonable. And instead, what we're faced with here is a situation where plaintiffs knew this was a professional liability case. They've admitted in their opening brief that they knew that that meant that they required expert testimony to prove their case. And instead of trying to meet the original deadline, they missed that deadline, and then asked for an enlargement of time until April 30th, and by their own admission, didn't do anything between February 16th and April 20th, the date that the court granted the order, to file their expert disclosures on time. Posed with that, the trial court's ruling was correct because plaintiff's conduct in this case was simply not a good cause. It wasn't a reason to postpone the ruling. A deadline further, I apologize. Plaintiff's counsel also argued that we never identified any harm as a result of the potential third enlargement of time. And I take issue with that statement because we did identify severe prejudice that would have resulted as a result had the court granted the third requested enlargement of time. Now, as I mentioned, that enlargement of time was requested on May 8th, 2012. We had a trial date scheduled in this case on July 16th, 2012. Had plaintiffs been granted another 30 days, which is what they requested, we would have been forced to essentially prepare two rounds of expert disclosures, complete all of the discovery in the case, and prepare the case for trial in the period of approximately a month. That's simply not a fair burden to place on the defendant in this case.
Counsel, was that argument made to the trial court?
It was, Your Honor, in our response to, I believe, the motion for reconsideration and the supplemental motion for enlargement of time filed by plaintiffs. But in addition to that, I think it's really significant to note that in a case that involves professional liability, expert disclosures are really crucial to preparation of the case. Until we have expert disclosures, we don't know what the theories of negligence, causation, or damages are. We don't know what additional discovery we need to conduct. We don't know what our experts need to do on a case. And so without their expert disclosures, we would have been placed in a really, really, really difficult position of preparing for trial in less than a month. And I think the other alternative, as the court explained, was that the trial court grant a continuance. And as we've explained in our brief, there are a number of reasons that a continuance is harmful to parties. And they're articulated with great detail in the Miller versus Brannon case that we've cited. But more importantly, I think in this particular case, our client was an attorney. His reputation is at stake in this lawsuit. He shouldn't be forced to sit idly by and wait while plaintiffs take more and more time to develop their case. It's prejudicial to him because it creates anxiety in litigants, as the Miller versus Brannon case pointed out. I wanted to respond to one of the arguments that plaintiff's counsel made concerning his injury, and I think that there's a couple of important points that the court needs to understand with respect to this argument. First of all, I think that it's important to note that there's no evidence in the record that plaintiff's counsel's injury would have prevented plaintiffs from meeting the May 10th, 2012 expert disclosure deadline. And in reviewing the court's rulings with respect to this issue, I think it's really important to consider the information that was before the trial court. Plaintiffs made this argument with respect to the injury in only one of their motions. It was the second motion for enlargement of time. And in that motion, they essentially said the plaintiff's counsel had been injured and said, quote, counsel is not expected to be able to return to a full work schedule for 1 to 2 weeks from now. That's page 379 of the record. So in other words, they didn't tell the court that plaintiff's counsel would be out of the office for 3 weeks. They told the court that plaintiff's counsel wouldn't be able to work a full schedule. In the interim, plaintiff's counsel managed to file two motions for enlargement of time, the supplemental motion for enlargement of time and the motion for reconsideration. And so it was quite reasonable for the court to understand that plaintiff's counsel could do at least some work. More importantly, there was no evidence attached to the motion, no affidavit, and no real explanation as to why the injury and the surgery that occurred would prevent plaintiffs from meeting that deadline. Now, the court, when faced with that information, and one other important factor, which is that the plaintiffs in this case actually had two attorneys of record listed on the caption. Mr. Ruffner was one, but he also had another attorney working with him, Ms. Rank. And the motion for enlargement of time that the plaintiffs filed didn't explain why Ms. Rank couldn't have done anything in the intervening time to get expert disclosures done. But when faced with this information, the court did what I believe was reasonable. It looked at the amount of time that plaintiff's counsel said that he would be working an incomplete or a less than full schedule and said, well, in that case, I'll give you an additional 10 days to complete your expert witness disclosures. Now, the really significant issue about this is on May 8th, plaintiff's counsel asked for reconsideration of the trial court's ruling granting an extension through May 10th. And what's surprisingly missing from that motion is any reference to the injury at all. There's no mention of the injury in the motion for reconsideration, and absolutely no indication that the injury prevented plaintiffs from meeting the May 10th expert disclosure deadline. Based with that information, I think it was perfectly reasonable for the court to decline to grant a third enlargement of time. But the other issue with respect to the injury argument is this argument was never raised in plaintiff's opening brief. And as a result, it's not properly before the court because this court generally does not consider arguments raised for the first time in a reply brief. I want to touch on just one more issue, I believe, before I talk about the harmless error argument. Plaintiff's counsel was pressed, I believe, on whether or not the trial court should have ruled earlier on the motion for the first motion for enlargement of time. But I think that there's a couple of important issues to remember here, and one of them was already addressed, which is that plaintiffs filed a motion under Rule 97 asking for the trial court judge to recuse himself, which had the effect of staying all proceedings in the litigation. So to the extent the plaintiffs are arguing that the delay in ruling was abuse of discretion, we believe that any delay was their own fault. But the other thing that's important to bring to the court's attention here is that plaintiffs could have, but did not, ask for an expedited ruling on their motion. And in the absence of making such a request, the HUDAC case, which we attached as supplemental authority, or that we submitted as supplemental authority, says that a party has an obligation to ensure that its motions are ruled on promptly. And that's just not what happened in this case. Plaintiffs didn't go to the court and say, we really need a ruling on this quickly so we can determine whether or not our experts are going to go forward and whether or not to fund them. They didn't ask for the court to set a forthwith hearing. In fact, they waited for the defense to file a status report with the court requesting rulings on a number of motions. Given those circumstances, the trial court was well within its discretion to deny plaintiffs' request for a third enlargement of time. And I feel like I have insufficient time left to cover the harmless error argument, so we'll rest on the briefs on that argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ruffner, you've got a minute and 17 seconds for whatever. A minute and 17 seconds for whatever rebuttal you would like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of comments in that limited time. Counsel asked a question in his argument. Well, what did plaintiffs do with the time afforded by the trial court? Well, that begs the question. How much time was afforded by the trial court? Trial court only afforded in its first order on April 20th 10 days. we've talked about, and I mentioned and stated in my April 29th motion what happened during that period of time. But even putting the injury aside, that still was insufficient time in order to have the expert complete the report and present it by April 30th, even if I had not been injured. The second thing is that counsel mentioned that there was substantial additional time granted to plaintiffs to designate experts. There wasn't substantial additional time. Even if you add up the two orders, the one that granted an additional 7 days extension of time after I filed the motion regarding my injury, and you add up the first one, which only granted 10 days, that's not a substantial period of time. The crux of this case is, are we going to tell people in Colorado that if you have trouble with the money to get yourself to court and trouble with the expenses, struggle as you might, that we're not going to do the best we can as a state to enable you to ultimately have your day in court? That's what was going on here. The plaintiffs, as we stated in the original motion, simply did not have the monies, sufficient monies, not only because of what happened to them in the underlying case, but just their status in life.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your briefs and your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. The division will issue an opinion in due course.